Hello, I'm here with Eric Weinstein, who is a managing director at Thiel Capital and a visiting fellow at Oxford University. Eric, great to have you back again.
Hey, Marshall, great to be with you.
We had an interesting discussion last year. We spoke somewhat about your history. This year, I wanted to go more into the substance of what you're actually doing. I know that you've been working a lot on the area of reflexivity, which is obviously a subject matter that's close to us. It's been close to George Soros. So let me start by asking you, what does reflexivity mean to you?
It's a great question. So when George Soros speaks about reflexivity, he speaks in a particular style, very intellectual, but a prose style and a philosophical style at that. I think one of the challenges has been to try to figure out whether these words mean something mathematically beyond what people imagine he's been talking about. So if you think about one formulation of reflexivity that he's given is that there are two functions. There's a cognitive function and a participating function. The participating function has agents who are interacting with the market and therefore causing the markets to change behavior. But there's also this reverse cognitive function in which the markets are actually causing the agents to change their minds. And we might think about minds as being, in some sense, divided into the belief state of the mind and the preference or taste state of the mind. So the key question is, does this look like anything that we're familiar with? Is it two sets of equations that might be going back and forth? And there's a very interesting formal similarity to a description of Einstein's gravitational field equations, where John Wheeler, who was challenged in trying to describe these tensorial differential geometric equations to a lay population, came up with the idea that what they really meant was that matter tells space how to curve, and space tells matter how to move. And so one possibility is that what George has really been saying is, in some sense, that minds tell markets how to move, and markets tell minds how to curve. But the question is, what would it be that was curving? And so part of our work has been to show that without any alteration, the centerpieces of modern economic theory form geometric systems, much more than analytic systems, that are in almost perfect correspondence with the major structures of geometric field theory in physics today, known as fiber bundles.
So you've covered a lot of areas there, but clearly what you've suggested is very much at variance with what I would call the classic rational expectations, neoclassical school of economics, and there is also, as you say, the cognitive function that you mentioned. There's obviously elements of psychology, neuroscience, and that, and I don't think economics historically has captured these areas adequately.
It's a really interesting point. One way of looking at it is that maybe rational expectations is a misinstantiation of an idea. And so that rather than evaluating the underlying idea, what we have is we have a failed instance of the idea. So, for example, if we imagine a representative consumer as having particular tastes or beliefs, we can look at that as a degenerate case of a probabilistic situation or a heterogeneous situation, where the idea is that if you're in the freak situation where all consumers happen to be exactly identical, then you would have a wave that was supported in only one point. It would be a degenerate wave. But then you could easily let out that assumption and have a distributed population where people held many different points of view, both at the level of tastes and beliefs. And so as you start to look at the idea of single representative consumers with perfect information, who are omniscient, et cetera, and you start to relax the assumptions, you end up with much more interesting data types with which to populate your models.
And if you relax the assumptions, though, I get the complaint is that amongst more conventionally economists is that if you relax the assumptions, you don't capture them in the model, and the model becomes less elegant. That's always been considered one of the weaknesses of the profession in many respects.
So. Yeah, that's why it's a bitter pill to find out that it becomes almost unimaginably elegant as it becomes more realistic.
In what sense? And that's, I presume, you being a mathematician by training as opposed to an economist, are seeking to apply some of these more elevated and elegant mathematical theories towards things such as reflexivity, for example.
Right. I think we don't seek elegance for its own sake, right. But elegance is usually
it's a byproduct of what you're of the what you're working with. In a sense, it becomes more elegant because you're working with a more sophisticated form of mathematics, which gives you something closer to reality. Hmm.
And it's also the trail of breadcrumbs that we follow mm-hmm. to find the most powerful, reusable ideas. One of the problems with the heterodox critique of modern economic theory is that it hasn't become very unified. You have lots of independent voices talking about things without some sort of an agreement or collapse or movement towards a more unifying perspective. And so elegance is usually the hallmark of interoperability, which is one of the things that that neoclassical economics has had and its critics have lacked. And so if you think about, for example, the unimaginable animal diversity found in nature, all of that is accomplished with only 4 nucleotides and 20 amino acids. So the key point is to have a tiny set of Lego that is almost infinitely extensible, but tends to be self-healing and is resistant to tampering. And that's really the point of the geometric program.
I'm curious, now of course, George has made his billions, there is some question as to whether he applies reflexivity towards his actual investment decisions. I mean, there was this joke that Paul Samuelson, for example, was a great investor, but he used to use technical charts all the time and actually used very little of his economic theories. I'm wondering if you, as a managing director at Thiel Capital, have found that you've been able to incorporate some of this into your own investment thinking decisions?
Well, I can neither confirm nor deny that. But
without giving me specific trades, I don't know my answer.
But since George isn't here, I don't mind telling the tale that when I met him first in Berlin, I was keen to tell him that I thought he might be saying something analytic where he simply didn't have the mathematics. And what we explained was that the system known as gauge theory is a differential geometric system in which we take derivatives by measuring the rise in a function above the run relative to a reference level that is part of the theory. But these reference levels can sit on top of each other like an Escher staircase. And when I showed that to George, his immediate reaction was that he had always been intrigued by the idea that Escher had captured the essence of reflexivity when he had read Gödel, Escher, and Bach by Hofstadter. So the preliminary indications are that this is not necessarily out of keeping because the optics look quite similar.
The other thing that's always intrigued me is that economics has always liked to style itself as a science, at least a social science, and although the most disparaging thing an economist can say to someone who doesn't practice what he deems to be real economics is that he calls him a sociologist. And by the same token, many of the mathematicians to whom I have spoken over the last several months, particularly my interactions with people like you at the Fields Institute, is that the economists themselves are using a very, very low-grade type of mathematics, the conventional economists, the neoclassical, shall we say, and that they're not actually, they are, in fact, to mathematics, what the buggy whip was to the car, actually. I'm wondering what your thoughts about that were.
There's certainly beautiful mathematics that show up in economics. No one would denigrate the fixed point theorems. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the way of casting arrows and possibility theorem as a topological obstruction. So economics is no stranger to beautiful mathematics. I think one of the problems is that economists feel that they've been burned, having bought snake oil on several previous occasions. And so there's, in fact, oddly, a lack of taste, where when you talk about gauge theory, many economists hear, well, that's some highfalutin thing that we hear about in physics. They don't see it or understand it as a version of the differential calculus, given that the marginal revolution really is a description of the penetration of differential calculus into economics as marginal thinking.
And in fact, in speaking specifically of gauge theory, you and indeed your wife, Pia Mullany, who now works with INET, she has you together have sought to use gauge theory as a means of calculating accurately consumer price inflation. That's long been a problem. I mean, it's an everyday problem, and we use it, for example, to calculate Social Security payments.
Sure.
So its impacts on everybody's day-to-day lives, even though it's a very, very complicated theory, and yet it's not largely been accepted by the economics profession.
Well,
or is that changing?
I think one of the great things about INET is that INET is capable of creating ecosystems that can evaluate such things. So we were just talking to Matthias Griselli, who works closely, obviously, with the Fields Institute and INET, who suggested that we bring in the interdisciplinary firepower needed to actually evaluate the proposition as opposed to just sort of falling back on prejudices and rules of thumb. So I think that that's, if that works out, and this in fact becomes recognized as a backwards compatible upgrading of neoclassical theory to include behavioral realism, I think that will have to be a great achievement of INET that Pia and I were in fact unable to do on our own.
And if we bring in things like behavioral realism, obviously the math you've talked about is important, some of the economics you've talked about is important. Do we have to bring in disciplines like, for example, neuroscience, psychology? Because particularly in areas like calculating bubbles, what the psychologists see when confronted with human beings confronted with conditions of radical uncertainty, i.e. the unknown unknowns, versus what the economics textbooks tell you how they behave. They're quite different.
That's true, but we have a pretty strong critique of so-called radical uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things is that no matter what innovations, so this is a conference obviously about innovation, whatever innovations are likely to be coming down the pike that we can't understand from the perspective of this interview, they're likely to be measured in quantity units, and they're likely to be priced in currency per quantity units, whether the quantities are clicks, kilograms, hours, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So what economics does brilliantly well is to combine the biology, which is at its core, because we are in fact apes choosing to interact with each other through markets, and wraps it in a vehicle that has been uniformized to look like an as-if version of physics. And so the idea that we can do all sorts of mathematical operations, comparing apples to oranges, let's say, but also all sorts of sophisticated operations on these otherwise heterogeneous and unwieldy vehicles, is the genius of markets rather than the genius of economics. Why economics would now be running away from the idea that we are spectacularly well poised to deal with the messiness of everything that can happen under, let's say, radical uncertainty or Knightian uncertainty, when we actually have the ability to know a great deal about the unknown unknowns ahead of time, because we know that they'll be wrapped in the mathematics of an as-if physical world.
I'm smiling because the discussion, in a sense, reminds me of some of the debates that one used to read about between Einstein and Heisenberg. And Einstein, of course, hated Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which you could argue in one sense is a variant of radical uncertainty. And his general theory was certainly an attempt. It really wasn't a theory, it was an attempt to capture reality as is. He was trying to model reality and then have it correspond to reality. So what you're suggesting is actually that economics could actually become very, very close to constructing its own kind of general theory as opposed to a Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Hmm. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, first of all, the prices and quantities of which we just spoke form what's called a system of conjugate variables, which is exactly the position of momentum operators in their quantum realization that Heisenberg was dealing with. So it's not necessarily just a loose analogy, but it's quite possible that it's tighter than that. Furthermore, if you actually look at what quantum mechanics does brilliantly well, it's to take what would have been uncertain and turn it into something that propagates with certainty. So propagation in quantum mechanics, without, in fact, is completely deterministic. Mm-hmm. So by converting uncertainty into certainty, in many ways, quantum mechanics is almost completely deterministic. In fact, the only thing that causes the famous indeterminate status of quantum theory is when you ask a question that is ill-suited to the state. That is, the state is in a so-called non-eigenstate of the question, which we label an observable. And so, except for that situation, quantum mechanics points to how successful one can be taking what looks to be uncertainty and making it look certain. I would also just point out that Einstein was really not complaining about what we thought he was complaining about in the popular idea. I think he just didn't want to absorb the strongly dogmatic view of quantum theory as if it were a fundamental that was a done deal. More, he wanted to keep it open, with the idea being that we didn't know exactly what it was. And I think that that's not a crazy position.
Is there any room, in light of what you said, for the role of irrationality in markets now?
Absolutely. In fact, Samuelson struggled with the question of something more basic than preferences. And so that if you take what is known as a distribution of hyperplanes that is non-integral, you come up with sort of rock, paper, scissors paradoxes about consistent preferences and tastes. It turns out that there is an extension of the work that we're doing with gauge theories where cardinal utility sits over ordinal utility, much the way the symmetries of particle theory sit over space-time. So you effectively have a taste-time situation. In that circumstance, I think that you, in fact, it's too difficult to explain here, but there's some quite tight tie-ins between the two.
And I think with that, we're going to leave it. As always, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I look forward to seeing what your new incarnation as MD at Thiel Capital does, because I'm sure that it will be adding a huge amount not only to our understanding of investments, but also to the overall profession of economics. Eric, thanks again for talking to me. It's been great as always.
Marshall, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.